Good afternoon. Opening the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, Thursday, May 7th, 2009. We have four bills on the agenda today, and I will be taking them slightly out of order. We're going to move House Bill 3020A up first to accommodate the schedule of Representative Matthews, who's here today. I'm going to start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3020A and ask Representative Matthews to come forward. And did you want to bring anyone with you? Do you have a...
Whoever's on the list testify from Attorney General's
okay.
office.
Well, I have Paul Sundermeyer and Jim Willis, and while they're coming up, I'll ask Lori to please summarize the bill for us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3020A engrossed makes knowingly taken advantage of a customer who is a disabled veteran or service member, or service member in active service, or spouse of a disabled veteran, disabled service member, or service member in active service, an unconscionable tactic and unlawful trade practice. It has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and the conflict says good to go.
Thank you, Lori. Welcome.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Committee. My name is Greg Matthews, for the record. I'm the State Representative for House District 50, which is the great city of Gresham, in the presence of greatness with me at the dais, so I appreciate them being here at the desk as well. This bill was kind of an effort between Representative Tim Freeman and myself, working with Attorney General John Kroger in his office, and, of course, our Department of Veterans Affairs. What this does is, in recognizing, of course, the deployment of our troops, we were recognizing that a lot of our families of the deployed service members are extremely vulnerable to fraud. Our disabled veterans are even more so vulnerable in a lot of different ways, whether it be by license plate registration, which identifies them as disabled vet, some of the listings, but a lot of these folks are known to the community. So rather than allow them to be preyed upon, we decided to get somewhat of a hammer in state that would be able to enforce these laws and protect these people further, which is where the Attorney General's office came in. What House Bill 3020A will add is protections for the disabled veterans and their spouses, as well as deployed service members and their spouses, by incorporating into Oregon's Consumer Protection Law some of the consumer protection provisions of the Service Members Civil Relief Act. It's a federal protection of family members, but this puts in place into the state of Oregon. As you may hear, I don't want to steal the thunder, but we heard in committee that there were some just very egregious acts that would make us think that shouldn't there be laws that would cover this under fraud, forgery, and those instances. And being a former law enforcement officer, I'd say that, yes, there are, but some of those laws just aren't strict enough when it comes to these types of acts. So this came with a great deal of support out of the House. So I certainly, I know that you rarely hear it because we rarely do in our committees, but I appreciate you finding the time today, all of you spending the time on this issue. And as we get closer to that June 30th deadline, time is of the essence and very critically important. So thanks for giving us your time today and allow us to speak. And if you don't mind, we'll pass it to the others that are here.
Thank you, Representative. And are you able to stay?
Absolutely am.
Okay, thank you. And then we have Mr. Sundermeyer and Mr. Willis. I don't know who's going next. And we do have your written testimony, so if you could please summarize that rather than read it and just tell us why you're here, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Go Absolutely. I'm Senior Assistant Attorney General Paul Sundermeyer. I'm here on behalf of John Kroger, our Attorney General, who very much supports this legislation. I just have a couple of comments. This bill would make actionable as a state law something that's already illegal in federal law. So people should already be complying with this, with what you're being asked to pass. And it's a question of what can you do with that? Well, you can go make a federal case out of it if you can get anybody to do it, which is virtually very difficult. So what we're trying to do is incorporate the provisions of this protection for these groups of people into the unconscionable tactics portion of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act in Oregon, and then make violations of the consumer protection provisions of the Service Member Civil Relief Act actionable as part of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Very simple, and I would entertain questions if you have any.
Thank you, and we'll hear from the rest of the panel and then take questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Willis. I'm Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I have submitted written testimony, so I want to go right to a couple of examples that have occurred right here in Oregon that make this bill necessary, in my opinion. One is that we have had disabled veterans who need mobility and have been measured in their homes for motorized wheelchairs and other devices. They've been asked to make a down payment. They've done that, and they never saw their mobile device, and they never saw the salesman again. This was done exactly knowing that this was a disabled veteran, and clearly took advantage of them. The other is that there are people who call these folks making fraudulent claims that their contribution will go to help other disabled veterans. Unfortunately, some of them have not only given their credit card number, but they've given their security code to these individuals who then go and clean out their bank account. And again, they're preying on them knowing exactly who they are and doing it because they're disabled veterans or service members' dependents where the service member is deployed overseas at the time that the crime occurs. And the final thing I'd like to say to you, Madam Chair, is that as a 32-year retired veteran police officer and former criminal investigator, I can't tell you how happy I would be to have a state statute that would allow me to enforce this law without having to try to build a federal case or to get a federal enforcement agency to take on one of these cases, which, if it's on a one-at-a-time basis, they rarely will ever make a criminal case or take it to a federal grand jury or anything else. In this case, we could simply conduct a state criminal case with the municipal police, county police, or state police. I think this is a very good bill, and I appreciate, as Representative Matthews said, the willingness of the committee to give us the time to bring it to you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Dredd.
Thank you, Chair. This is a great bill, but I want to actually go one step beyond this bill. And is there anything that we can do? There's a lot of countries that are jamming a lot of emails that it's just absolutely bogus. If I read one more time about the pot of gold that was found in Saddam Hussein's Iran and or Iraq, rather, and that if you send so much money, will help us get us out and keep the freedom for all Americans. I mean, there's scams that are really seem to be targeting vets as well, and they seem to stem from Liberia, Czechoslovakia. You got any ideas on what we can do to put a kibosh on that thing?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Girard, I get the same exact emails every day. I should be worth millions by now. I mean, from Liberia, as you said, from Middle Europe, and even from South America. And then, of course, those people who are representing themselves as members of the United States Armed Forces who say they're stationed in Iraq or Afghanistan and they found gold bullion or they found all these kinds of things. I am told by my information technology people that we are doing a much better job of screening these kinds of things, especially if it's in a foreign language. But I'm still getting Russian language documents. I don't know what they say, but I'm sure it's probably that they found some money that they want to share with me. So I think the issue is one that could probably be taken up by our central data office here in state government, and they could probably tell you what they can do to kind of cut down on these things. But as good a thing as the internet is, it's got its bad side and its good side, and the bad side is those kinds of messages that we're all getting, that every American is getting. So I'm going to have to leave it to the high-tech people to tell you what kind of screens and filters they could do that would be even better. And in closing, I'd say this. There are programs, they do cost money, that require that you have given permission to the person that sends you the email before it will even come into your system. But for busy people, especially for state senators and state representatives, it then causes the constituent to have to send a second message to get permission from you to send what their request was. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to work very well with our electorate here in Oregon, but that's certainly your decision, not mine. But there simply needs to be more done. I couldn't agree with you more, Senator.
Thank you. And I have a question for Mr. Sundermeyer, just so that the record is clear here. It's my understanding that this is creating additional civil liability but not criminal liability, and that if there is criminal conduct on the part of the actor, that could be pursued by another avenue. Is
correct.
That
yes, correct? Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions for the panel? Representative Matthews.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, in a case that Mr. Willis didn't bring this one up, but this is another act of what people are doing, and that is they're contacting our veterans, and they're offering to basically for a fee adjust their reimbursement for their disability. So they want to increase their disability from, say, 60% disabled to 85%, and they'll do that for a fee. There is a process in place through the Department of Veterans Affairs where people can reapply for that, and that doesn't cost anything. But there's folks out there that are selling this as a marketing tool and preying on our victims. And the last thing I'll say is, again, thanks to Attorney General John Kroger, his whole office. This was something that John and I were out walking, imagining what if, you know, we were to get elected. And I told him, I said, you know, the one thing I wanted to do fundamentally was bring programs that matter to our veterans, particularly those when they're deploying, because they are very vulnerable. They're off defending this country. Their families are home providing. And I often say, as a firefighter, I make choices. My wife makes a great deal of sacrifice. But the reality is that typically our soldiers make less money as a soldier than they do in their civilian world. So they're giving up their occupation to defend our country. And while they're gone, their families struggle with that differential in pay to make the bills meet. Now, there are some folks out there that are legitimate companies that are willing to do the effort to work with them so that they can live by their means. However, unfortunately, there's other companies that's exactly who they're looking for. And so I think this bill will help us address that and make sure that, you know, it keeps those folks that are acting in that manner held accountable, which is what we're looking for. And I really, again, can't thank you enough for your time today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for bringing the bill forward, Representative, and for your testimony. Paul Evans, next on our list here. And as you're coming up, I will remind the committee, as I was carrying the bill that we had from this committee earlier in the session, the Senate Bill 386, I had a story about a veteran whose family was receiving phone calls from a debt collector threatening to contact the commanding officer and have the person who was serving in Iraq roughed up a bit because his bill wasn't being paid here. And so I know that this is a very serious problem. Welcome, Paul.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul Evans. I'm currently policy advisor to Governor Kulongoski for Military and Veterans Affairs. I submitted some written testimony. I'll just try to talk very briefly. I think the phrase at this point in the game is a good pass or good bill do pass. But in this particular case, I really have a passion for this bill. In 2003, when I was a captain with the 720th Air Control Squadron, as we pushed into Baghdad, times were hard enough in Baghdad at that time without my airmen and sergeants having to worry about what was happening to their families while they were deployed. And though you would expect that even people that say they have no shame still wouldn't do certain things, taking advantage of veterans and serving families during those times really does occur. And as the war has continued, as the National Guard and Reserve has become operationalized in Oregon, as the stress on the family units have become more severe, especially on families that have had significant impact having to do with mental or emotional harm and damage, anything we can do to protect those folks, I think, is something that we are duty-bound to try and put into place. House Bill 3020 is, I think, a remedy that provides greater protection. It is addresses a real problem, not something that most people in the country have a lot of experience with, but nonetheless something that is real and profound. And I believe that it's one of the more important pieces of legislation that you'll have an opportunity to decide upon. It would be nice if we lived in a world where you didn't have to have this kind of bill, but I really think that we need it. And especially with the 2,600 that have just left for service in Iraq, I know that they're going to think a whole lot more about the mission and less about concerns at home if they have these protections on the books. So those are my comments, and I try to answer any question you might have.
Thank you for your testimony and for your service. Any questions for Mr. Evans? No, thank you. Anyone
thank
else
you for
here
the opportunity to
testify?
To be here.
Thank you. Anyone else here to testify? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3020A and open a work session on House Bill 3020A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3020A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves House Bill 3020A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Somebody went to get Senator Burdick. Is she in the hallway? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll. We'll have her add her vote later. Will you call the roll, please, Sam? Excused.
Senator Gerard?
Yes.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Bonamici?
Aye. House Bill 3020A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the chair will carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3020A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2188A. And Lori, can you please summarize the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2188A engrossed prohibits mortgage banker, mortgage broker, or loan originator from making negative amortization loans without verifying the borrower's ability to repay. It requires the mortgage banker, broker, or loan originator advertising or conducting business in a language other than English to provide certain disclosures in the language in which parties conducted the transaction. It prohibits an award of attorney fees to a mortgage banker or broker that is a prevailing defendant in an action brought by a borrower, if borrower took the action in good faith and gave specified notice. There's no revenue impact. There's a fiscal statement issued that was given to you, and that's it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. First, I'll have Corey Streisinger and David Tatman, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is David Tatman, Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk about House Bill 2188A, which deals with mortgage lending practices. This has been a subject of considerable attention over the past couple of sessions, and there have also been quite a bit of changes since this issue was last addressed by the legislature. There's been action at the federal level, and of course there's been a lot of action in the mortgage industry and in the economy. And as a result, this bill is pretty different from the ones that have been considered in past sessions, and it's also quite a bit narrower. I want to say before getting into the details of the bill that the mortgage lending industry is very important to us here in Oregon. Oregonians want to buy homes, and an active and strong mortgage industry is important to enable them to buy homes and also to refinance loans, and in today's economy that's more important than ever. And we've worked very closely with our industry on a number of measures to strengthen the industry. The industry here has always supported strong standards, strong enforcement. We appreciate that support, and there are bills this session that we've worked closely together on. And our goal with this bill is the same, to maintain a strong mortgage lending industry here in Oregon that also provides strong protections to Oregon consumers. As I'm sure you're aware, during the real estate boom earlier in this decade, we saw a significant number of new types of mortgages proliferate. They included a lot of adjustable rate mortgages. They included a lot of mortgages with introductory teaser rates that then increased later in the mortgage. And some of those you may have heard of go under names like payment option loans or pick-a-payment loans, which offered variable terms of repayment that could include a negative amortization feature. That is, payments that don't even produce enough money to pay the interest so that the unpaid interest is added to the principal and the amount owed actually gets larger as the loan goes forward. And that, of course, only goes on for a certain period, and then at some point during the loan's term, the payments need to go up very considerably or the loan needs to be refinanced. These loans generated high fees, and they were primarily intended to be bundled and securitized and resold. And in my testimony, I've summarized a little bit about what happened to the mortgage market, but I won't go through that today because I think we're all unfortunately too familiar with what's happened over the past year and what the long-term triggering event has meant to our economy. As a response to the problems that became recognized in the mortgage industry, there were actions taken at the federal level. There were new regulations adopted by the Federal Reserve Board and U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and there was also legislation passed by Congress. And so a number of the issues which we had been discussing over the past couple of sessions were actually addressed in those new federal restrictions. But House Bill 2188 is intended to complement those federal restrictions, but also fill in some remaining gaps. And I will say there are some other areas that we've identified that we believe are already covered by existing mortgage lending law, and we intend to clarify some of those issues through rulemaking as well. House Bill 2188 itself covers three specific issues. Negative amortization loans, disclosures in languages other than English, and attorney fees. These proposals were developed with input from a work group that met during the interim, and I'd like to thank a lot of the participants in that process, members of the industry, consumer representatives, the chair of this committee, the chair of the House Consumer Protection Committee, who participated through many, many hours of, I think, very productive discussions about these issues, different ways to approach them. The group didn't reach consensus, and I'm not representing that this bill is a consensus bill, but I think because of those discussions, we ended up with a fairly carefully tailored set of proposals, and I can tell you personally that we certainly benefited, and I think the bill benefited from the very thoughtful contributions of all of the people involved. So turning to the specifics of the bill, the first portion of the bill deals with negative amortization loans. Now, the new federal regulations, one of their key features are the restrictions that they place on higher-priced loans, essentially subprime loans. And for these loans, the federal regulations limit prepayment penalties. They prohibit making those loans without evaluating the borrower's ability to repay, and they require a lender to verify income and assets on which they're relying in making the loan. So we think those same three protections established by the federal regulations for subprime loans should also apply to negative amortization loans, and that includes those with a payment option that can have a negative amortization feature. These are very complicated loans. They pose significant risks, and it's often very difficult for borrowers to understand that the payment, what's going to happen to the payment several years later after their initial low payment is no longer in effect. The loans, in our view, are suitable for very few borrowers, yet they were sold very broadly to many borrowers who I think everybody would now concede really they weren't suitable for. Borrowers who just didn't have any ability to repay those loans once the payments went up. In the work group, there was some discussion about whether we should actually just prohibit negative amortization loans altogether. This bill does not take that approach. Instead, what it says is it takes those same federal standards that now apply to the subprime market, and it applies them to negative amortization loans as well. Prepayment penalties would be limited so that borrowers aren't locked into these loans. The lender would need to evaluate the borrower's ability to repay the loan, and income and assets on which the lender is relying in making the loan would have to be documented. No more of the no doc or low doc or sometimes called liar loans. That we would require documentation if that income is being relied on. One question that's been raised is why these provisions in the bill would apply only to mortgage lenders and not banks. With respect to state chartered banks, which we do regulate at the state level, nobody engaged in this discussion has actually advocated for including banks in this bill. The consumers have not, and members of the industry have not, although there are members of the industry who wish they were not included in the bill. They have not actually said they would support the bill if bankers were included. The reasons for that is that, first of all, banks are regulated under a very different regulatory scheme. We examine them, and we examine their loan programs and their loan quality, and they do very little residential mortgage lending. They actually have not been the source of these problem loans, so we've attempted to focus the bill on where the problems actually were. Now, the situation is somewhat different with federal banks, and there clearly were and have been federal banks engaged in these types of problem loans. But we don't have the ability to regulate federal banks. We're preempted from doing so, and that regulation is the responsibility of the federal government. But state-chartered mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, are our responsibility. The feds have made clear that they expect state regulators to step up and regulate state-chartered, state-licensed institutions. So in our view, the fact that we can't protect all Oregon borrowers against these types of practices doesn't mean that we shouldn't do what we can. So for that reason, even though the bill can't reach federally chartered banks, we think that it's focused in the right place. I do want to then move to the next part of the bill, which is the disclosures. The new federal rules and federal legislation significantly enhance disclosures, and good disclosures mean that borrowers can understand their loans. That's important because we want borrowers to have responsibility for making good decisions. It also protects lenders because if good disclosures are made, they can't later be in a situation where there was argument that there was a misunderstanding or miscommunication. Among the most useful disclosure documents is the newly revised good faith estimate, and a copy of that's attached to my testimony. It has to be provided to the borrower within 3 days after the application, and again, if there's a change in cost of more than 10%. And the new good faith estimate document, it's the kind of disclosures we would like borrowers to have. It's clear, it's plain, it covers key points like what's the interest rate and can the payment increase and by how much, whether the loan has a negative amortization feature, whether it has a balloon payment, the lender's charges, the relationship between the lender's charges and the interest rates, which charges are subject to change, and there's also actually a shopping chart that allows the borrower to compare different loans. Some other key disclosures are provided by the federally required Truth in Lending Act disclosure. So understanding a mortgage can be very challenging, and these documents are intended to help, to make it understandable. But it's a significant challenge when the borrower does not speak English and the documents are provided only in English, and particularly where oral representations are being made in the borrower's language. So what we are proposing in this bill is that when a lender chooses to advertise or solicit business in a language other than English, and a substantial part of the communication about the loan takes place in that language other than English, when the lender has bilingual or non-English-speaking loan officers who deal with that borrower, we think it's appropriate to have these basic disclosure documents provided in that other language. So House Bill 2188 provides that in that circumstance where the lender chooses to advertise or solicit in another language and communicate about the loan in another language, the good faith estimate document and the Truth in Lending Act document have to be provided in that other language, and the borrower also needs to be provided with a statement saying that the closing documents will be in English only and that the person may want to bring someone with them to the closing who understands the documents. Under the bill, DCBS will provide the translations for the three most languages commonly spoken in English in Oregon other than English, which are Spanish, Russian, and Vietnamese. We have heard some concerns from lenders that they use software to produce these disclosure documents to do the math, and that the software is available only in English and we believe Spanish also. We don't see this as a barrier. If a lender chooses to advertise and negotiate a loan in another language, say Russian, they can use their software to print out the disclosures in English, which federal law requires, and then print out from our website the document in Russian and hand both of them to the borrower. We simply want the borrower to be able to put those documents side by side and understand what the document says. So, once again, it's a lender's choice whether they're choosing to solicit business and to do business in that language. For a lender that does business only in English, this requirement won't apply. The third part of the bill, and I think I can say it's probably the most controversial part of the bill, deals with attorney fees. And under current mortgage lending law, there is a private right of action for violations of lending laws if a borrower is harmed. Attorney fees under current law can be awarded to a prevailing party. And during our work group discussions, we heard concerns that a homeowner who has been harmed by a violation of lending laws might nevertheless be afraid to bring a lawsuit, even a lawsuit that's a strong case, because of the risk that he or she might have to pay the lender's attorney fees if the lawsuit isn't successful. So to address this, House Bill 2188 provides that attorney fees couldn't be awarded against a borrower in a residential mortgage transaction who's bringing such a lawsuit unless the plaintiff has brought the action in bad faith or for purposes of harassment, but the borrower would also have to meet an additional criteria, which is they would need to send notice to the lender in advance of their intent to file a claim so that there is an opportunity to try to settle the case before a lawsuit is filed. And this is very similar to the standard set out in the Truth in Lending Act. So those are the three elements that are addressed in House Bill 2188. I'm happy to answer any questions, as Mr. Tatman is as well.
Thank you so much. Did you have additional testimony, Dave?
Madam Chair, no.
The question
just
answer?
The questions.
Thanks. Questions? Senator Jurek?
Thank you, Chair. The question I have, and it's actually what I think is a failure with this bill, is I personally don't think negative amortization was the cause of the collapse. I think the secondary market, where it was all bundled and then sold and then banks got overexposed, that caused the collapse. This doesn't deal at all with secondary markets, and I'd like to know why.
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, you're right, it doesn't, and that is primarily a subject of federal regulation. Again, there are limits to what we can address here at the state level. I'm pleased to say that there have been considerable discussions, considerable action, and there are probably going to be more to come to address some of the federal side of the business, and I think a great deal of concern is being shown about the securitization.
Quick follow-up. In the House, this it squeaked by. I mean, it barely passed. What was the major objections in the House when, you had 24 no votes in the House. That's quite a few, and it was bipartisan on those. The attorney fees, there was that the major objection, or was it just across the board, or do you really know what the major objections were?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Girard, I think you'll probably hear some of them from future witnesses, so if it's all right, I think I'll let them speak for themselves.
I wanted to ask if you happen to know how many negative amortization loans are out there now. Are they being marketed now? Is it something that's frequently offered to Oregonians at the present time?
Madam Chair, what we've heard is that there are a lot fewer being offered today than there were at the height of the real estate froth, but that there are still some being offered. And in addition, I think our feeling is that when the market recovers, they will come back, and that this is probably the right time to put a floor under the standards for those loans.
Thank you. Senator George?
I want to thank both of you for spending so much time with me personally going through the bill. And one of the questions you raised early in your testimony was this idea that we, in essence, have three types of regulations if this bill is to pass. One is the federal regulations of the federal banks, then you've got the regulations of the state banks, and then you've got the regulation of the mortgage lenders. And I'm looking at it from a kind of a practical standpoint. Do you think that this creates any problem from the consumer's perspective? Because the consumer, I doubt, really separates out those. I'm just going to go get a home loan. They have different layers of protection between the different types of institutions they have. And it seems like to me that would add confusion to the consumer. And it seems like to me if we had a bill that made all of our state regulations consistent with the federal regulations, that'd make a lot more sense to me. As far as not confusing the consumer and giving a consistent standard upon which everybody would know that we're working under the rules.
Madam Chair, Senator George, the areas that we're addressing in this bill are ones that are not addressed at the federal level. I wish they were. I think our responsibility is to look at what problems are being are placing our Oregon borrowers at risk, and what's the right balance of regulation to address those. The issues that we're putting before you regarding negative amortization loans and disclosures in other languages, that we think they've resulted in real problems for Oregon borrowers and that we can help. And again, to me, the fact that we can't help everybody doesn't mean we shouldn't help anybody.
Quick follow-up. Any idea what percentage of mortgages are done in each of the three different venues? Federally chartered financial institutions, state chartered financial institutions that are banks, and then these mortgage lenders. Any idea what the distribution is?
Madam Chair, Senator George, we are getting data now that's better than we had before. I can tell you that based on, we have just gotten our first round of data from the bill which you passed in the February 2008 session requiring reporting. So in 2007, we had 116,000 mortgages issued by state chartered mortgage lenders who would be covered by this bill. Now, our general, the problem is we don't have quite as precise data about the denominator. Our general understanding is that about 60% or 60% plus of mortgages in Oregon are from state chartered or licensed institutions, and that the vast majority of those are the entities that we're addressing by this bill.
Got you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is more a comment than a question, but I just want to say that I think this bill is extremely important, and I had occasion to be involved in a real estate transaction and was going over the forms, as you do, with the escrow agent, who was telling us that she has had the experience of having people sitting in her office where she's just reading the forms to them and finding that they were completely clueless about what kind of transaction they were engaged in, including things like that they would be, you know, paying nothing toward the principal of the loan for the first 10 years, and they really weren't aware of that, except that she was just neutrally trying to tell them what was in the documents they were about to sign. So obviously there's a problem, and I think these are important steps to address it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'm going to call another panel up, and I'm, for those of you who are wondering, alternating between proponents and opponents. So next I'd like to have Jim Marquis from the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association and Chris Ambrose, also from the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. Chris Ambrose, a member of our legislative committee and an attorney that practices in this area, is with me today. And I'm going to start off by just saying that we believe that borrowers need to understand what they're getting into, and certainly to the extent that we can help them do that, we want to be helpful. From a policy consideration, I just want to say at the outset that I believe that as a policy, when the state of Oregon embarks on regulating an activity, whatever that activity is, they should attempt as closely as possible to regulate that activity in the same manner for all who engage in the activity. And this bill simply misses the mark in with respect to that policy consideration. This bill singles out a particular segment of the industry and says for this narrow little group of people, mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers, these rules will apply. Now, my organization has non-depository institutions, state chartered institutions, federally chartered institutions, as well as people who don't loan any money. And we have a few brokers. The committee needs to remember that mortgage brokers don't loan money. I mean, they don't really loan money in the same sense that a bank loans money. They are brokering a transaction for somebody else. And that somebody else may be a state chartered institution, it may be a federally chartered institution, or it may be a private individual or other kind of entity. It may be a finance company, it may be a bank, it may be a credit union. The federal rules with respect to negative amortization loans work because they apply to everyone engaged in the activity. What this says is that for a negative amortization loan that is not a high-cost loan, as defined in the federal regulations, a mortgage broker or mortgage banker who is licensed under Chapter 59 is fully responsible under Section 2, I believe it is, to basically underwrite the loan. And in many instances, the lender that they are brokering the deal for maintains that they should be the ones to carry out that function because it's their money. And so they do. And what you do by passing that particular provision in this bill is to put the broker under this provision and the people that he's making the loan for not under the provision. And by the way, if the broker fails to do this, it's a Class C felony. That's 1 year in jail and $250,000 fine. And we just don't think that's appropriate. So my main concern about this bill is that if indeed, and I'm not sure that we ought to be going where we're at here in terms of the provisions, and Mr. Ambrose is going to speak to the attorney provisions, which we're opposed to as well. But if the legislature is going to go down this road, then we really strongly believe it should apply to everyone engaged in the activity. So with that, I'll happy to answer any questions or turn it over to Mr. Ambrose.
Thank you. We'll hear from Chris first and then take questions. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name again is Chris Ambrose of Ambrose Law Group here on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. I'm here specifically to address the attorney's fees provision that's set forth in the House bill. While we appreciate the notice provision that I know has been the subject of some discussion in the work groups, we don't believe that the carve-out is sufficient to address the fundamental fairness that we believe should be appropriate for these types of circumstances. There's a misconception, I believe, that the licensees that are going to be subject to this particular bill are behemoths that can basically address attorney's fees and litigation as simply a cost of doing business. However, the reality is that most and certainly many of these licensees are small and medium-sized companies to which litigation needs to be taken seriously, is taken seriously, and one or two civil litigation lawsuits can put these companies out of business. That simply is the reality. We don't need more companies going out of business in this state. Without the risk of consequences to the plaintiff or the borrower in this case, the harm to a defendant, the broker or the lender, can be catastrophic from both a monetary standpoint and a livelihood standpoint. We certainly recognize that it's important that you don't want to dissuade borrowers who have been wrong from coming forward with their legitimate claims. Having said that, there should be consequences, we believe. A borrower should have to strongly consider in advance the merits of their litigation with their counsel before they bring an action that is going to potentially do so much harm to these small and medium-sized brokers and lenders. The practical effect of having a provision in there that is going to provide that that the attorney's fees can be awarded against them in favor of a defendant if they have not acted in good faith, we don't believe is going to have any merit from a longer-term perspective. Having been practicing law for over 20 years now, I have seen very rarely, in fact, one or two occasions in which a court has actually stood up and said that a plaintiff has brought an action not in good faith or more particularly in bad faith that has resulted in an award of attorney's fees. It just from a practical effect doesn't happen. While it looks good on paper in the bill, we don't believe that from a practical effect, again, it's going to have any real detriment to a borrower going forward with a claim that is not in good faith. The consequences, again, to brokers, lenders that have to deal with these provisions and have to deal with the litigation is catastrophic again. The costs of litigation, of course, are exorbitant. There's very little downside risk to a borrower going forward who does not believe that there's going to be a net consequence to them by having to pay attorney's fees or costs when all is said and done. There are requirements for surety bonds, as you all know, for the brokers and lenders in this state. The consequences of having a civil litigation matter, one or two pieces of litigation brought against the brokers, lenders, again, is going to have very negative consequences to the point where it may preclude them from doing business in the state because they can't get the surety bonds. They also get errors and omissions insurance, which also is going to be detrimental, or they're going to have a detrimental effect if they're unable to get their errors and omissions insurance on the same rationale. The public record, of course, is harmful in and of itself. And perhaps most importantly nowadays is that there are reporting agencies such as MARI, M-A-R-I, which is the Mortgage Asset Research Institute, which is similar to a FICO-type scenario in which the mortgage industry is now tracking every civil piece of litigation against any mortgage lender or broker in any state. Similar to FICO, while these brokers and lenders have the opportunity to respond to some extent, they have very little opportunity to challenge the public record, meaning that there are decisions made, again, similar to a FICO scenario, on the lines of credit that these borrowers or these brokers, rather, are able to get. They're affecting detrimentally the warehouse lines that these brokers are able to get. They're detrimentally affecting their joint venture relationships. Bottom line is, across the board, these reporting agencies are picking up the litigation and having an extreme detrimental effect on the brokers and lenders who are having civil litigation matters filed against them. Bottom line is, it should be taken incredibly seriously by a borrower before they file a lawsuit. Also, while there are certainly select, such as the Truth in Lending Act, that have one-way attorney's fees provisions, they are far more rare than they are common. The Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act has a mutual prevailing party fee provision. The Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act also has a mutual prevailing party fee provision. Bottom line is that the only cases or the only situations that we've seen in which something such as this has been put in place has been where there has been an extremely compelling reason to narrowly focus on a particular industry for purposes of making it so detrimental to a broker or to a defendant that they should face the consequences of a one-way attorney's fees provision. We don't believe that the broker industry in the state of Oregon should be singled out for this type of provision. We believe that the net effect is potentially catastrophic to the brokers and lenders because of the lack of consequences to borrowers by being able to bring their lawsuits. And I'd be certainly happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. I wanted to ask, you said that you haven't seen very many cases where there's been an attorney fee provision for bad faith. Have those been under statutes that expressly allowed for attorney's fees to be awarded when the against the plaintiff when the case is brought in bad faith, or under general prevailing party?
I've checked provision. From both an anecdotal standpoint, both based on my experiences along with talking with other attorneys, and then I've also tried to collect as much information as I can via case law from those statutes that are put into place. And there were, I could locate two cases in the past 15 years under, and I apologize, which statute it is, a federal statute. I believe it was dealing with the securities industry. And the courts went on to address the nature of the factors that they take into consideration in order to determine whether or not there's bad faith or not, and or whether there was good faith in going forward. And the factors that they considered made it so incredibly difficult to justify an award of attorney's fees against a plaintiff that it, for all practical purposes, was only applied in a situation where there was absolutely no basis for going forward. It became clear from the evidence that was presented before the courts that the action was purely for purposes of harassment, such as is identified in this statute, that there was some type of underlying motive by the plaintiff to get back at the defendant, if you will.
And another question. Mr. Marquis mentioned something about criminal penalties, and I was just glancing at the statute. Are you aware of instances where there have been criminal penalties under Chapter 59? Does it happen very often?
I have not seen that apply, based on my experience. I know it's been out there, but nothing that I'm personally familiar with.
Thank you. Question, Senator Dredd.
Yes, this is for the question is for Mr. Markey. You talked about mortgage brokers, and I just kind of want to, you know, I'm not always the smartest one up on the dais. I just want to make sure I understand this. The mortgage broker takes the information from the lender and gathers all the credit information and then asks, or from the borrower, rather, and then asks various lenders if they're willing to make the loan. They actually don't make the decision if that loan, or they don't have money in the fight other than the fee for the mortgage, the brokerage. Is that not correct, or am I missing something?
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, I believe that's pretty accurate. What I would like to do is defer to, we do have two mortgage brokers who are going to be up here on the witness stand, and perhaps since they are in the business and I'm not, they could probably more adequately answer that question.
Just a comment. I find it really ironic is that the person making the decision isn't held liable in this case. The person that actually just gathered the information is the one that they're holding as hostage here in this bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, that's been my concern, that we've singled out this one segment of the industry. And I do recognize that the state of Oregon, under case law, does not have the ability to develop regulations like this for federally chartered institutions, and we simply can't do that. But there is certainly nothing stopping DCBS or the legislature from adopting this same standard for state chartered institutions that may be across the street from one of these people. And therein lies my dilemma. And frankly, the department testified today that they felt they should be doing all they can. Well, I would submit that they haven't done all they can in this bill. They've done a little piece of it.
Thank you. And our next, I'll set other questions. Our next panel will be Sybil Hebb, Angela Martin, and Matt Wallace, please.
These are obviously opponents, right?
Alternating panels. Okay. Welcome.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Angela Martin with Our Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2188. I'll share briefly that when Matt walked in late and heard you, Senator Girard, say that you wholly support this bill, he looked at the agenda and said, huh?
He knows me well. I told him I'd give him one bill. I've already given it to him.
The story's been told and told again. Risky and unsound lending practices have had cataclysmic effect on world economy. Opened up my computer today to work on my testimony, and the headlines on the news jumped right out at me. The federal regulators doing the assessment of banks, the soundness test, have come back with results. Banks must find an additional $75 billion worth of capital to remain on the safe side of sound banking. The shocking piece of this is that it was touted as good news. The fact that we're only $75 billion away from a sound banking system tells you how far we've traveled down this road on the backs of unsound and unsafe lending practices. We also heard that Congress and federal regulators have taken some steps to address the problems that we've seen in the mortgage market, but frankly, those steps were not far enough to address the problems that are unique to the Oregon market. We know that Oregon was not one of the leaders in subprime lending. However, we were one of the leaders in non-traditional loans, primarily those called payment option, pick-a-payment, negative amortizing loans. They go by many names, but the effect is the same when they are sold to folks that they're simply unsuitable for. Under House Bill 2188, negative amortizing loans would still be available as a tool for financially appropriate homeowners. We all can cite family, friends that have used these as a wise investment tool. Their home hasn't sold yet. They want to buy another home, so a negative amortizing loan makes sense to leverage your financial resources. However, these types of loans did not make sense for families who never expected their income to go up, but it was a simple fact of the loan that the payments would increase. Their incomes never would. Before you is a scenario, a letter submitted by a couple that had just this type of experience. Bob and Marty Barney, tricky name to say over and over again, would have liked to have been here today, but could not get off of work, so they submitted this letter and asked that I share certain pieces of their story. They purchased their home in 2007 and came to become homeowners, and actually the seed and the idea of home ownership was planted in their mind through an advertising for a home ownership class. So they started off saying, I want to be a smart, savvy consumer. We want a home. We don't know how to go about doing it, so let's take this free class. The class was offered by a team that could, it was one-stop shopping. They had the realtor, the mortgage broker, and the appraiser, all, actually, I think family relations brought them all together. But they were able to offer not only advice on how to purchase a home, but they could sell you, help you with every aspect of it. So they went through the class, explained that given their income, they're in their 60s, their income's not going to go up, they could afford $1,000 a month. The mortgage broker ran the numbers, did the charts. Marty herself is the first one to explain that this was a completely overwhelming process for her. But they developed a loan and said, we're going to come up with a payment that you can afford. And it was a payment that they said was $1,030. $30 more than what they had said is their bottom line, but they were going to stretch and do it. When they received their first statement is when they realized they were in a negative amortizing loan and that the $1,030 was the bare minimum payment that they would have to make, and that to make a payment that actually covered principal and interest, the full payment, was $2,400, more than double what they knew they could afford as a family. At this point, they realized that they were in over their heads, attempted to refinance. They couldn't find any refinance loan out there for them, so they started going through the process of trying to sell their home. It has been on the market ever since. They have agreements to do short sales. They haven't found a buyer. They're stuck. The rest of their story goes on to the fact that they were misled from their broker and contacted an attorney to help sort through this mess with them. And their attorney, Phil Goldsmith, had to present them with the reality. If we sue and you lose, not only will you not get the money you need to make yourself whole, you could be liable for paying the attorney fees for your lender that you would like to, or for the broker you worked with that you'd like to sue for misleading you. So as an attorney, was able to say, you have a case. I think you have a viable case, but you have a real risk that you have to consider. And in this letter, you'll see that the Barneys explained that was not a risk they felt they could take. So, again, they're trying to sell their home in a short sale. They're remaining very positive. This is the kind of law that we need to protect these types of homeowners. Negative amortizing loans would still be available. We won't see a proliferation of lawsuits, and I can say that because we look to other states that, unlike Oregon, do not put consumers on the hook to pay the attorney fees for folks that they are challenging as abuse them, and when they lose in law. Mr. Ambrose, when they lose in court, Mr. Ambrose brought up an important point that the state's Consumer Protection Statute on Unlawful Trade Practices Act has two-party, two-way attorney fees. It's interesting to note that Oregon is one of only three states that in our primary consumer protection statute puts consumers on the hook, puts them on the line, that if they lose in court for a good faith case, they have to pay the thousands of dollars in attorney fees. It serves as a deterrent to effective access to justice. With that, I state that we certainly endorse the other aspects of this bill. It's a good bill. We think it's important to put us back on track to solid home ownership standards. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Angela. And in case anyone's wondering, it's Florida and Alaska, I believe, are the two other states that we join in that area. So, Matt, are you going next?
Sure. For the record, Matt Wallace, consumer advocate for Osberg. Senator Girard, I'm going for two.
You're not going to get it on this one.
You haven't heard my testimony.
Again.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to weigh in support of House Bill 2188. I do think it's worth noting at the outset, I mean, there is a lot of blame to go around for the mortgage meltdown. There is certainly a lot that happened in the secondary market where a lot of these loans were bundled and sold and packaged into tricky financial investments and instruments that turned out to be a really big mistake. A lot of other things were happening, though, too, and some of those are really where the rubber hits the road here at the state, and that's where consumers and lenders and brokers are interacting, and that's where we see some of the most troubling practices. I think Director Streisinger mentioned some of the more exotic loan products that have been widely credited with helping to put us in the mess that we're in now. The so-called liar's loans, also occasionally called ninja loans or Nina loans, no income, no job, no asset. I mean, these are loans that have the feature of not only, sometimes having pretty sophisticated and dangerous features such as negative amortization, where that principal can rise over time, but in addition to that, were made just without any consideration of the borrower's ability to actually repay that loan or their assets or their job or their income when going into that loan. And I think that's the key thing, especially when considering the negative amortization piece of this bill. Again, the bill doesn't actually ban negative amortization loans. They are sophisticated sophisticated financial instrument which can be appropriate in some cases, but it does apply both the same standard that exists now federally for all subprime loans and what I think is just a very common sense sort of standard to this particular sophisticated loan type, which is that if you're actually going to give somebody a loan, you'd better make sure or take reasonable steps to make sure that they have the ability to actually make the payments on that loan. And I think that's the key piece that's important to remember on the negative amortization piece here. The other two pieces of the bill, I think, are also equally important. On enforcement, I think I'll just echo what is often the case for consumers who have been wronged under consumer protection statutes is in many cases the consumers are already struggling, financially. In many cases, they've been wronged, especially in the case of their home, to a pretty significant degree. And I think lowering the bar for consumers to seek redress when they've been wronged in court is an appropriate thing to do. And again, given where our sort of consumer statute is statewide in Oregon compared to where it is in most other states, is also a pretty appropriate and a pretty reasonable step to take. And then finally, on the disclosures piece and languages other than English, I also think that's an important section of the bill, and I think is one piece that actually can make sure that we do provide a lot of clarity for consumers. And I think that clarity for consumers in terms of the information that they're receiving certainly is important, and that additionally is just one step forward that we can take for Spanish, Russian, Vietnamese-speaking consumers to make sure that they know what they're getting into, and apply again the new federal disclosures, which apply to all loans to this particular class of customers as well. So with that, I'll actually leave my spoken comments there, and we'll just actually note the final bit. We definitely think there are other places that we can take forward action in making sure that we prevent the next mortgage meltdown, and appreciate and look forward to working with the Department of Consumer Business Services to figuring out which pieces of those can be clarified through rule. So that's that.
Thank you, Matt. Sybil?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here. I appreciate all of the attention to this issue before you today. Very much in support of the three basic distinct issues provided for in House Bill 2188. I echo the comments of those that have gone before me on this panel. I just had a couple of specific pieces that I wanted to add in support of each of the three distinct pieces. With respect to the negative amortization loans, I would just draw your attention to the fact that all lenders and brokers in Oregon are already having to go through an assessment to pay based on the new federal requirements that apply to other high-risk loans. This simply adds negative amortization loans into that same category of other complex, high-cost loans. We think that's appropriate because we see, unfortunately, in our offices, people similar to the family that Angela described, people who simply didn't understand what it was that they were getting into. These loans are often advertised as having such low initial interest rate payments. People often have the misconception that those are the only minimum payments that they will need to make. And unfortunately, because of that marketing and because of just a simple lack of understanding, people get in over their heads, and it makes sense to add this category of loans to those other loans that are already being assessed. And the assessment would be consistent, so there wouldn't be new standards applied. It would just be a new category added to those standards. The other piece that I wanted to specifically speak about is the translation requirement. We have had a significant number of clients seeking our help whose primary language is English, Russian, Vietnamese, and often these clients suffer additional barriers to disclosure. The principle behind the new disclosure requirements that were passed by the federal law was really to ensure that people had a better chance of understanding what it was they were getting into. The disclosure requirements are simple, and they're about key pieces of the loan. And with respect to the population who face that additional burden or additional barrier of not understanding English, we believe that in the circumstances that are addressed in the bill, when a business actively solicits business in another language, and in addition to that, also conducts the negotiations in that language, it's fair to ask them to provide those disclosures that are required for all other loans in that same language that they're soliciting the business in and providing the negotiations in. So we think that it's a fair requirement in that it's a narrowly applied circumstance. A business would not, you know, inadvertently fall into having this requirement apply to them. They would have to be actively seeking this business and actively conducting the negotiations in that language. And then the requirement that does apply is only of the two key forms, and those forms are going to be translated by the department. So we think it's a fair and reasonable proposal that will provide really a great benefit to a category of particularly vulnerable people. I did also want to draw your attention to some copies of advertisements that we have seen in some of the communities in which we provide services. So this is the sort of effort that we are looking at, is when businesses take the steps of soliciting business in, for example, Spanish, in the Spanish telephone directory. They are actively seeking the business of consumers who speak that language and advertising their services in that language. And I think that inspires a specific trust in the population of consumers who come forward. And it's, I think, often the case that they then rely on the oral negotiations and discussions, and it makes sense to make sure that they have a backdrop of those disclosures of those key pieces in that same language. The only other piece that I wanted to address was the third piece of the bill, which is the attorney's fees provision. And I would echo the fact that we believe that this is an access to justice issue when we are talking with our clients about the possibility of moving forward with a case we think is very legitimate. There are often people who just simply can't afford to take the risk for themselves and for their families of the potential of paying high business corporate attorney fees. And so we think that the attorney fee provision of the bill is a reasonably structured one that actually encourages settlement and discourages frivolous claims. The fact that there is a requirement that a letter be sent before the suit be filed is a good thing that helps the company decide how and if to respond. And often that can either encourage a settlement, or it can provide the basis, the defense that would explain to the consumer, oh, there's not a case here, there was a defense, I'm not going to move forward. So we think that it actually will prohibit or discourage frivolous litigation and at the same time erase a barrier that we see really preventing people with legitimate claims from coming forward. So unfortunately, there's not access to affordable attorneys or for low-income consumers. So I very much appreciate your attention to all of those issues, and thank you.
Thank you. And if we can keep questions short, please, because we still have another panel and two more bills.
One question.
Questions? Go ahead.
Thank you, guys. Any concern at all? I interviewed somebody one time on English as a second language. I was shocked to find out that Portland Public Schools educate in something like 50 different languages. So it's not just the top three and English. Any concern at all that certain already disadvantaged citizens or residents who do not speak English or one of the top three languages may not get access to the lending industry because of the fact that lenders would find it too risky to try to comply with this and instead would just go away completely from any small demographic groups that may not speak English? I mean, it seems like to me that this would be a huge, it would dissuade me from even sort of advertising to certain demographic groups, and makes me nervous.
Senator George, members of the committee, I don't have that concern. What we find it with respect to the clients that we're seeing coming into our office is that primarily they are people who are speaking one of those top three languages. I think that probably if I were a business determining whether or not I was going to spend the money to advertise in the Yellow Pages, for example, I'm going to be thinking about what's the size of my consumer base, and is it worth it for me to spend this money to advertise here as opposed to advertising in the other Yellow Pages or in other ways, in other languages. And so if you're specifically soliciting business from a particular population that speaks a particular language, then it's worth your while to be doing that solicitation just generally right now. And I think that mostly that's happening in those top three languages. I think that in the less commonly spoken languages, we're not seeing this level of solicitation. But I also think that if we do see that, then the requirement of translation, and again, it has to be solicitation and negotiation in that language term. So those two requirements have to be met before the translation requirement would apply. And even then, it's still just a basic, simple form. The translation of that form is not that complicated a process. If you're a business offering those services to a language that's not commonly spoken and you're advertising and you're negotiating in that term, it's probably pretty easy for you to also translate the form. It's not a very long form, so we see, and the disclosures that are required are not numerical. So once you have the form translated, you could simply fill in the numbers, and so we think it's not too big a burden.
Thank you. And I have one more panel I'm going to bring up together. That would be Todd Williams, Charles Murphy, and Shane Jackson, please. Okay. Welcome.
I'll go first, Todd.
Okay. Step up.
I'll be very brief then. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I'm here to talk, for the record, I'm Shane Jackson, representing Mortgage Express, a mortgage company here located in Tigard, Clackamas, and Vancouver, Washington. I'm here to speak in opposition to House Bill 2188 today. Just as a general overview, I'll be very brief. Like I said, we feel that this bill will unduly burden the mortgage brokers of the state and allow the federally chartered institutions to operate without the burden of these laws, and feel that that creates an unfair business environment. The first section I'd like to speak to is, once again, the ability to pay clause. We have a lot of problems with the concept of a mortgage broker determining somebody's ability to pay, whether it is a negative amortization loan or not. You'll probably find that our clients will just drop the negative amortization loan altogether, then have to abide by this regulation. The second part I'd like to talk to is in Section 3. The translation to other languages. Senator George referred to the 54 different languages spoken at the Portland Public Schools. It does represent a certain slippery slope, but the idea that a mortgage broker is required to stand by and deliver documents in a language that they probably don't understand is something that we just don't feel comfortable with. That I would just like to backtrack a little bit. I had the great pleasure of being on the Mortgage Lending Task Force with Senator Bottomici. And at that point, I did bring up the concept of foreign language problems, problems with people who don't speak English, getting these documents in English, and trying to translate them. But my where I wanted to go with this was, my intent was, is that mortgage brokers and bankers would give every convenience to the borrower to bring in a translator. When you buy a house, the home buyer often gets their own home inspector. The same concept would apply here. You would bring in somebody who understands your language and can translate the documents for you. So it's not the burden of the mortgage broker, or they don't take on that liability of translating the documents. The buyer of the loan gets all the stuff that they need. That's where I was headed, but I didn't intend this. And I'm not even going to touch Section 4. I think Chris Ambrose did a very good job stating the opposition to it. And that concludes my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Shane. Who's going next? Ted?
I'll go next. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, thank you so much for the chance to come here before you to speak about Hospital 2188. For the record, my name is Todd Williams. I am president and broker of record for Evergreen Mortgage Corporation in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, or OAMP. I'll add a couple general comments first, and then a couple of specifics thereafter. Mr. Marquis hit on a very important piece with regard to the uniformity of application of how our laws are administered. In response to Senator Girard's earlier comment, a mortgage loan originator, whether they be a mortgage broker or a loan officer for a state-chartered bank or federally chartered bank for that matter, is nothing more than a salesperson. They build relationships, receive information from a borrower. It's then packaged by a processing center and is sent to an underwriter for an ultimate loan decision. The loan officer does not make that loan decision, regardless of the channel, especially as a mortgage broker, because a mortgage broker does not have funds available to make that loan themselves. They are a facilitator in that transaction. Excuse me. I was recovering from a cold this week, so I'm sorry. They're a facilitator of that transaction only. A couple of other pieces relative to the three major pieces of 2188. I'll hit them quickly because we provided some talking points before. As we've indicated, we don't create the loan programs. We don't underwrite the loan programs. With regard to the language issue, understand that under this bill, we'd be asked to provide three documents up front in the borrower's native language, so long as we, quote, advertise in that language. Seems like it would make some common sense. Here are the problems with that situation. First and foremost, the documents that are supposedly so easy to create in other languages are not so easy to create. They're created by computer programs. The calculations are algorithmic. They are not something you bang out on a math calculator. They're done by computer programs. We haven't created those documents by hand. I've been in the business 20 years. We stopped doing it 16 or 17 years ago. At a minimum, it would take us more than a year to have the ability to create those documents through the software programs. And again, it would only be able to be for just a few languages available. The second piece is this, and it goes with the attorney fee privilege. And I'd like the opportunity, if I could have the committee's indulgence, to just give a scenario or example of how we see this situation playing out.
Todd, we have about 8 minutes to finish this bill.
It'll be about two, so I'll be as brief as possible. Hispanic family comes in, makes loan application from a loan originator who happens to have a logo on his card or on their website that he speaks Spanish. These people speak perfectly good English. They talk in English. They have the conversation in English. The loan is consummated, processed, closed, and funded in English. 3-4 months go by, and for some reason, unbeknownst to anybody's control, that borrower loses the ability to pay their loan. And they've decided that they get a hold of an attorney contacts them and says, you may have been harmed because your documents were not provided to you in English, and your last name happens to be Garcia. Under the provision of this statute, a complaint would be filed, a pre-civil complaint would be filed against myself and my firm, which is a Class C felony. I have a choice of writing a check to pay these people off, or going to court. As soon as it's filed a public record, that is a Class C felony against myself personally as well as my firm. By Oregon Statute 59, I have to report to the division immediately that a Class C felony has been filed against me. As soon as that is done, that same report goes to all of my bonding companies and all of my E&O companies, and I am out of business. Period, the end, no questions asked. There are currently two companies in the entire United States left that are willing to offer mortgage broker or banker bonds or E&O insurance. Two. They both testified for us. I can have them in writing. Our bonds would be stopped immediately. That is the issue that we have with the combination of this statute, with this proposed bill. And I'll conclude my comments at that point and shave some time for Mr. Murphy. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Murphy?
Hi, I'm Charlie Murphy. I work for Sierra Pacific Mortgage. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm in over my head here. Although Sierra Pacific is the 13th largest lender in the United States, and I've been with them for about 10 years, so I kind of know what the larger lenders are trying to do. And I know what specifically we're doing in relation to a couple of these things. Part one says we need to determine the borrower's ability to pay on a NEG-M loan. Right now, on all loans, we are required to show not only the ability, but that there's a net tangible benefit to the borrower in doing that loan. It does not get through any of our underwriters without that. So I'm wondering, when I look at this, why we would limit ourselves to the ability to pay for negative AM loans only. And by the way, they aren't being done. So I think what we need to do is, as soon as some new concoction comes from Wall Street, we're probably going to have to come up with a new statute or something like that and come up with the next loan, the next new bad loan that's around, and cover that one. So I think this is just, quite frankly, too limiting. The other one I want to talk about for a second is, again, the language thing. I heard, excuse me, I don't recall his name, earlier someone said that if the good faith estimate is written in the borrower's native tongue, that they would understand what's going on. And that's a complete false sense of security. That has nothing to do with whether they'll know what's going on. Right now, I have to bring an interpreter in. I'm glad to. If I was to do a loan to someone who is Spanish-speaking, for example, that's the law. Or that Spanish-speaking individual would bring someone in as his interpreter. Now, that's a good way to go, because that's an independent third party who will speak properly to that individual and interpret. I like it better than simply changing the language into the into Spanish or Vietnamese or anything else. I just think that in a couple of these cases anyway, we're defeating the true purpose of the federal law and what we are doing right now as loan originators. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Mr. Murphy.
Yes.
You said you're not doing negative amortization loans anymore. Why is it? Just because of how the market is now?
They're not available.
Okay.
And I don't know when and if they'll ever come back, but they're not being sold out there. It's a defunct product. Whether it comes back or not remains to be seen, but have you seen one done in the last year?
Not even probably two, other than some workouts.
But the negative amortization loan, if I may, Madam Chair, Senator Burdick.
Will you state your name first, please, for the record?
Todd Williams.
Thank you.
The negative amortization loan fits certain markets at certain times for certain people. When we have come from a period of low interest rates, when we go into a period of rising interest rates, they're a very popular product. In the early 80s, when prime and fixed rates were in the 20s, negative amortization loans were 10, 11, 12%. They were the only first mortgages being done at that time. The same occurred in the early 90s after we came out of the time of low fixed interest rates. So we haven't had a period of like that in some time. I suspect, since we're in a very low rate environment again, once rates start to climb and we get to 7, 8, 9% fixed rates again, for well-qualified people that understand them, they will be a popular product again. The issue that created this was a layering of risk, though, not of an individual product.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, just to clarify one thing, Todd, I think your scenario about the translation issue, really, I think if you look at the bill, it's not just that you advertise in that language, but you also have to conduct the majority of the transaction in that language. So your scenario was that the transaction had been conducted in English. I don't think that then you would even come under the provision of this bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, may I respond to that?
Go ahead.
Based on the way the statute, proposed statute, would be structured, it wouldn't matter. I would have a choice of writing a check to whoever filed that complaint, or it would become a complaint of public record, which would be a alleged Class C felony against me, and you can ask the division to come back up. I would be required to report that to the division that a Class C felony had been filed against me. Not adjudicated or confirmed yet, just filed. And I would have to report that, and it would go to all of the agencies immediately.
Thank you. And thank you for your testimony. And, in fact, I was going to ask the director or Mr. Tatman to come back up in the remaining 2 minutes to answer two quick questions I had.
Vito with us?
Yes. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
While you're coming back up, because I do want to do the other two bills, would you please describe the logistics of the disclosure form requirement and also comment on the criminal liability issue and when that has to get reported?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm Corey Streisinger again, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'll take the first one and let Mr. Tatman take the second one. With respect to the disclosures, our view is that, and we do have rulemaking ability under these general statutes, so if clarity is needed, we would be happy to do that by rule, but our view of the bill is that federal law requires these disclosures to be made in English. We would assume that the software that produces the documents in English would continue to be used, and that for the documents that we then provide the translated version would be printed out off our website, and both documents would be handed to the borrower so that they would be able to have the software version, which is going to be in English, and then they would be able to understand what it said because the language is prescribed by federal law. The form is uniform, and they could say, box number one that has these words in it, I now know what they mean.
Thank you. Mr.
Can I follow up on that?
Sure.
Not knowing too much about foreign language, but there are certain things that are not directly, there's not a direct correlation between one language and the next. And so I'm having a hard time understanding how you could have a contract in English and then have a contract in Spanish. And they would, and by your testimony, they'd say exactly the same thing. I have a hard time understanding that when there are different words, and et cetera, that don't have a correlation from one language to the next.
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, the contract itself would not be translated. The bill doesn't require that. The only things that would need to be translated are the good faith estimate form, which is a short, clear, plain language, four-page form, the Truth in Lending Act form, which is also a short disclosure statement, and a very simple statement that the closing documents will be in English. We have a multicultural communications program in our department that translates a good deal of our materials. We make many of our materials available in Spanish, Russian, and Vietnamese. We have consulted with the head of that program who feels comfortable that these documents could be translated easily.
Thank you. And then the other question had to do with the criminal, when a criminal case would be filed or alleged.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is David Tatman speaking, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, part of DCBS, Department of Consumer Business Services. With respect to the criminal issue, it seems to me that this is getting a lot of concern about it. I think it's important to note that the criminal law has been, as it is today, in place since 1993, and it has not caused any significant concern or problems. As you heard Mr. Williams say, he's been doing this for 20 years. A couple of pieces around the criminal law. If you are a loan originator and you have a criminal conviction, you have to disclose that to us. If somebody sues you and the lawsuit is over a certain dollar amount, over $10,000, you have to notify us of that lawsuit. That has nothing to do with a criminal charge. The only way a criminal charge can be brought is if a police officer or somebody that's in our division prepares an investigation and then refers it to a district attorney's office. The district attorney's office then decides that they want to go forward with it, and then it's taken to a grand jury, and a grand jury indicts somebody. To suggest the fact that somebody gets sued over a misrepresentation is tantamount to a Class C felony is just a misrepresentation of the circumstances. So I think there's a little confusion about that. I understand the concern people have, but the law has been consistent since 1993. This doesn't change anything about that. And so I don't think that the concern is as it's been characterized to boys.
Thank you very much.
Senator George. Quickly. I think what we're trying to get at is, let's say, for instance, I know a lot of people who can speak both English and Spanish very well, but their native tongue is Spanish. Two total great English speakers get together, but they're more comfortable conversing in Spanish. Okay? They have this conversation. The contracts are in English. They both speak English incredibly well. They go to they sign all the documents. It's in English. Since they both speak English, you know, the documents aren't translated or something. Then what happens is that the loan goes bad, and somebody says, I have a right of action. And because we had a lot of the conversation in Spanish, because they're both more comfortable in that. You see what I'm saying? And what happens, it seems like to me, that there's a lot of this gray area, and if they file that class action, at some point you've got to refer this, under this law, you've got to refer this for that next step. You don't?
No.
Could you, though?
Chair Bonamici and Senator George, if we felt there was criminal behavior going on, we could make that referral. I'm here to tell you, I've been doing this for 20 years. I was a former chief of enforcement that was responsible for those decisions in the department or in the division. We would not be referring somebody who makes a decision that really impacts an individual. It has to do about a dispute about whether he said or she said. What we would refer would be something that is tantamount to fraud. If somebody's engaged in criminal conduct that takes advantage of a circumstance, so for instance, if you went to somebody and could not get the answer, you could not be understood, a good example would be a real life example. About 10 years ago in Yamhill County, we had a situation where we had a number of mortgage brokers who were engaged in fraud and misrepresentation, and we did refer prosecution to Yamhill County. But that was a case where people were being defrauded or losing money. The situation you're describing, it doesn't rise to criminal conduct. And we would not, A, make the referral. We're not obligated to make the referral. I can't imagine a police officer, as busy as they are today, would take the time to make that referral either.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2188A and open the public hearing on House Bill 2614 and ask Lori to please summarize the bill while Ed Bartholomew and John Brenneman come up, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2614 requires a landlord of a dwelling located in a 100-year floodplain to notify a tenant that the dwelling is in the floodplain. It allows the tenant not receiving notification that suffers subsequent uninsured flood loss to recover from the landlord the lesser of actual loss or 2 months' rent. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and conflict says good to go.
Thank you so much. Do you want to thank you for your patience?
No, fine.
State
thank
your name
you.
And
Madam Chair,
your testimony,
I'm John Brenneman. I represent Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. They're park owners. We have about 500 members statewide. When this bill first came up on the House side, I sent it out to my board electronically and asked them to take a look at it, and nothing came back in the form of a comment. And after the bill passed the House, I informed the board again electronically that it had moved forward. And Ed's wife, Kathy, Ed's one of my members here who is with me. Ed Bartholomew's wife is on the board. He read her email, and he had some questions for me about the bill that I could not answer, and I asked him to come today and just tell you what his concerns are.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
State your name, please.
Ed Bartholomew. I built a community in Washington County that was as part of the permitting process. I was required to keep all the dwellings outside of the floodplain. Both the city and the county reviewed the plans. Washington County hasn't allowed a dwelling to be in the floodplain since the 70s. The problem I'm having here with this is, oh, and then, by the way, we since then had a 100-year flood in 96, which the flood came nowhere near our dwellings. And then FEMA comes along. Somebody back in Maryland starts drawing on a map, and all of a sudden a bunch of my dwellings are showing up in a 100-year floodplain. I've spent hours and hours talking to Maryland and having surveyors send elevations and on and just trying to talk common sense. I go, listen, folks, we just had a 100-year flood. These homes weren't anywhere near the 100-year flood. So now you're showing them in the 100-year floodplain. I have low-income people in my community that are being required to pay flood insurance from their lenders just because of this. You know, I'm sure that their money could be much better spent in another way. And then now this is coming down the pike, and in a very bad market, I'm trying to rent a house, and I am forced to say, oh, by the way, this is in the floodplain. That's my problem. I think that maybe a better way to go would just require the landlord to disclose if the dwelling had flooded in the 96 flood. I think would be simpler.
Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator George?
This is more of a comment. Mr. Barthelme is saying is really key here. I just had a piece of property that's clearly outside the floodplain that three different maps said I was outside the floodplain. But one map from one lender said I was inside the floodplain. And because that one lender, or that one map writing folks were the ones that the lender used, I had to pay $1,500 for a flood insurance for something that went through not just went through the big flood and was nowhere near but going underwater, and it was for my own property. And I think these maps are not very accurate in a lot of situations. My folks, and you're invited to come out to the former state senator's house, it sits up on a hill above their shop. And I would say that the elevation between their house and their shop is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 40 feet, well, 30 feet up in the air. Their house on the map is inside the floodplain, and the shop really didn't flood in the 96 flood. And so this is one of the things that happens is these maps are not accurate. And I'm not sure a lot of landowners would actually know that a house that they had is in the floodplain. I think Kaiser. Hmm. You know, Kaiser has a lot of subdivisions that are now in the floodplain. And so I started thinking about this, and I could see that these maps would really put these things in an interesting liability issue.
This deals with disclosure, not
right.
with the mapping.
Yeah, but we don't know what's in the, we don't know what's in the map.
We don't know.
I'd like to follow up with a comment. I actually have property that was in a floodplain that we elevated, so we filled, but still by the map, it's in the floodplain. But we got the permits to bring it up, and so it is 2 feet above the floodplain. It did not flood in 96. It hasn't flooded in any of the major floods. So the way that this is written, I think it needs some clarifying language. I'll put it that way.
Any other questions? Nope. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2614 and be getting back to the chief sponsor of the bill with some of those questions. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2658A. Thank you for your patience. We have about 10, 12 minutes. Plenty of time. Lori, can you please summarize the bill for us?
Madam Chair, House Bill 2658A requires dental technicians upon request to provide to the dentist or patient with the location where oral prosthetic device was manufactured. There is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and conflict says good to go.
Welcome.
Chair, thanks for being here. Members of the committee, thank you very, very much for allowing me to speak before you today. On behalf of, my name is Margie Hoffman. I represent the Oregon Dental Association, and we brought this bill forward this session because we realized over the interim that our dentist didn't have access to information regarding where permanent or temporary oral prosthetic devices are made. So that's a crown or a bridge, things like that. The reason that we feel it's important to have access to this information is that recently a crown was placed in a woman's mouth, and it caused really bad inflammation and swelling, and she actually had to get it surgically removed. When they tested the crown, they found that it had a high level of lead, and the National Laboratory of Science studied 8 crowns in Ohio to determine if the high level of lead was due to the fact that the lead was put in the product or whether or not that was because the crown was manufactured in a facility where they manufacture other lead-based products, and it just picked that up along the way. So the National Laboratory of Science is now studying this nationally. They're doing random sampling from dental manufacturing facilities that produce domestically or that are located in the United States and those that are located outside of the United States. Pending the outcome of that study, we feel it's very important for our patients and for our dentists to be able to keep a record of the locations where these devices are manufactured so that if a problem is found to exist with a particular facility, they're able to access the information and they know who's gotten what from where. It's a very simple bill, and we hope to have your support.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Girard?
Well, actually, this is, I'd like to say this, is a good bill.
I'm looking at you for answers here.
Yeah, you know, but I kind of want to, it isn't just crowns, partial dentures are the ones in the lower class. You might order a denture, a partial denture for someone. That's broken in two. There's a framework, and the framework might be made in China for all we know. And so it could be a potential problem. And so I think that it is important that we be able to access where certain things are made. So I do think it's a good bill.
Great. Thank you. Sarah Burris?
So where was the lead tooth, the crown made?
In China.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. Questions? No more questions? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2658. There wasn't anybody else here on this. No. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2658A.
I started out with a
pro. Oh, sorry. Madam Chair, I just figured we were done. We all decided that it was all sound like a good bill. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2658A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves House Bill 2658A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Ann, will you please call the roll?
Senator Burnett?
Aye.
Senator Girard?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair
George? Aye.
Chair Bonamici?
Aye. House Bill 2658A moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Guess who's carrying the bill? Senator Girard will carry the bill.
As long as the summary sheet has the right committee, then it came.
Oh, great. Oh, that's me.
Closing the work session on House Bill 2658A and adjourning the committee for today. Thank you.
So mean. On the public record, no less.